this morning is Wygod v. Wells Fargo Bank, 11-14-23. And we'll hear first from Mr. Woodrow. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Woodrow, and I represent the appellant, Lori Wygod. Your Honors, as the nation suffers through an unprecedented foreclosure crisis, Wells Fargo continues to ignore the rights of homeowners under the Home Affordable Modification Program. The District Court, in dismissing Ms. Wygod's claims with prejudice, found that they were barred as impermissible end runs around the HAMP's lack of a private right of action. This Court should reverse and remand for three reasons. First, no end-run theory or doctrine prohibits Wygod from pleading state law claims. Second, and although it was not raised by Wells Fargo below, Wygod's state law claims are not preempted. And third, Wygod has sufficiently pled each of the elements for all of her causes of action. Ultimately, no basis exists for denying aggrieved homeowners like Wygod their day in court. Turning to my first point, Wygod's state law claims are not an impermissible end run around the HAMP's lack of a private right of action. The fact that HAMP does not provide a private right of action does not prohibit state law claims because no rule denies a state the right to provide a traditional damages remedy for violation of common law duties when those duties parallel federal requirements. As this Court observed in Dersch Energies v. Shell Oil, citing its earlier decision in Spearman v. Exxon Coal, many federal rules serve as the jumping-off point for state claims without converting those claims into claims under federal law. Wells Fargo attempts to stitch together language from in opposite cases in an attempt to create legal fabric for its end-run doctrine, but there are noticeable holes. None involve a federal housing program with trial plan agreements that seemingly cry out for state law enforcement. At best, the cases Wells Fargo cites hold that private rights of action should not be read into statutes where the statute provides effective and mandatory administrative remedies.
What do you say about your opponent's suggestion that there is, in fact, an administrative process by which consumer difficulties can be addressed and, indeed, relief given to the consumer?
Your Honor, the supposed remedies that Wells Fargo cites are hollow at best. The first, a formal complaint procedure through Freddie Mac, simply does not exist. Wells Fargo cites a case that mistakenly thought Freddie Mac had such a procedure, and Wells Fargo states as fact in its brief that such a procedure exists, but it does not. When one visits Freddie Mac's website, Freddie Mac instructs the aggrieved homeowner to call their servicer for help. With respect to Wells Fargo's citation to a HOPE hotline, a 1-800 number, Wells Fargo's own Congressional Oversight Panel report admits that housing counselors under that HOPE hotline have no authority whatsoever to overturn bank decisions. At most, Wells Fargo suggests there's a super committee at the Treasury called the MHAC that is supposedly empowered to reverse a bank's decision. The only authority Wells Fargo cites for this is a Congressional Oversight Panel report, and the only authority cited in that report for the contention that the HOPE hotline can provide such relief is conversations with Treasury staff. None of those staff members are identified. None of the directives provide that the MHAC has such authority. And a quick search online shows that when a borrower actually reaches the MHAC, the MHAC sends a letter informing the borrower that the MHAC can't even commit to providing a response. Simply, the record is devoid of any evidence that any borrowers have successfully reached the MHAC and used that process to compel Wells Fargo to change its loan modification denial decision.
On the other hand, if Congress did create an administrative remedy, we have the further question of whether it's exclusive or not. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. And in this case, none of the supposed administrative remedies that Wells Fargo cites to are mandatory. Rather, they all would seemingly, to the extent they exist, would seemingly complement the enforcement mechanism that Treasury chose by using a trial plan agreement. In fact, the EESA...
I guess the real problem here is that the 500-pound gorilla in this case isn't even in the room, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The Treasury Department is not to be heard of as to whether there is such a remedy or there's not such a remedy, and if there is such a remedy, whether it's exclusive or non-exclusive, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The Treasury has not sought to intervene in this case, and to my knowledge, they've not sought to intervene in any other case involving this issue.
Anybody ask him?
Not that I know of, Your Honor. There have been subsequent supplemental directives that have come out since the tidal wave of litigation began a year and a half ago, with several hundred of these lawsuits being filed against almost every major bank. And in none of those directives has the Treasury come out and said that borrowers lack the ability to enforce their trial agreements. Everyone agrees there's no private right of action. The question is, can YGOD enforce our trial plan according to its plain terms? The Treasury has had ample opportunity to speak to that in the directives, and yet they have not. In fact, the HAMP directives expressly state and mandate that all servicers must be aware of and follow all state and local laws. It would seem inconsistent with any sort of intent to preempt, either expressly through conflict preemption or even the field, if the Treasury went out of its way to remind servicers to follow all state and local laws. That language would be rendered superfluous if they were indeed preempted.
So, Mr. Woodrow, if we rule in your favor, we open the floodgates in this case, don't we?
No, Your Honor. The floodgates have already been opened. Hundreds of cases have been filed, and many judges have disagreed with the lower court in this case and allowed the claims to at least proceed to the discovery phase. What Your Honors would be doing by honoring the TPP agreement would be saying that borrowers have the rights that they can expect under the plain language of their contracts. It would enhance the efficacy of the program by forcing lenders to adhere to what they've agreed to. As a result, more borrowers would find themselves receiving the permanent modifications that they should be receiving under the program instead of being summarily dropped and then faced with claims by the bank of blanket immunity, essentially.
Do you have any legislative history that leads us to that policy?
Unfortunately, I don't, Your Honor. The EESA empowered the Treasury to create a housing program aimed at preserving home ownership. The EESA itself was careful to specify that any remedy afforded to the Treasury would not be exclusive of the rights of any other person. Inferring from that, coupled with HAMP's mandate that servicers follow all state and local laws, and added to that the fact that the Treasury selected as its mechanism a TTP agreement that says the words "I agree" or "I understand" 8 times apiece. That strongly signals an intent to have state law enforcement be the mechanism as opposed to a private right of action for enforcement.
Mr. Woodrow, I understood the defense to be arguing that your client is trying to get a modification for which she is not eligible under HAMP. I understand your complaint to allege that she does qualify and has qualified for all of the requirements for the TPP and the permanent modification. Can you enlighten me as to what the actual dispute is here, and in particular about the role of investor guidelines in determining an individual homeowner's eligibility for relief?
Yes, Your Honor. The discrepancy arose after my client was placed into her trial plan and had complied with its terms. As we set forth in our brief, Ms. Wygod was what we refer to as a pre-verified borrower. So in 2009, when the program came out, banks had a choice. They could either place a borrower into a TPP based on verbal information late to be subsequently verified through documentation, or they could pre-verify the borrower, at which point the borrower would not be subject to re-review. At some point, I believe in October of 2009, after several months of my client's compliance with her TPP agreement, Wells Fargo decided to reevaluate her improperly under the program. And what Wells Fargo, we believe, where their error was, is that they miscalculated her taxes and her income. And my clients, Ms. Wygod, contacted the bank several times and pointed out the error to no avail. With respect to Your Honor's question about investor guidelines, unfortunately, we don't have information as to what those guidelines were. And Wells Fargo's notice to my clients that they were being dropped from the program due to investor guidelines is cryptic at best.
Okay. In your, if I recall correctly, in the first amended complaint, you refer to your clients' conversations with the bank. Is it correct to say that, in essence, your position is that the bank erroneously applied the so-called waterfall analysis in that reevaluation?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The bank, under Supplemental Directives 17 and 18, the HAMP directives specify that review is limited to those unverified borrowers, borrowers who are placed in the trial plan without being verified like my clients were.
And in that analysis is done for pre-verified borrowers before the TPP is started, right?
Yes, for borrowers like my client. And since these lawsuits have been filed, the Treasury has come out and prohibited now banks from placing borrowers unverified into their trial plans. Now it's the case where all borrowers must be treated like Ms. Wygod was treated, where you must be verified before entering. And the April Congressional Oversight Panel report that's cited by the defendant is in the Joint Appendix at 133. That Congressional Oversight Panel report applauds the Treasury's move and notes that once a borrower is pre-verified, the only basis for dropping them from the program is not a re-review, but it's a borrower's failure to make their trial payments. As Ms. Wygod made all of her trial payments in this case, she should have received a modification agreement for her signature. Turning to my second point, and although it wasn't raised in the lower court, Wygod's claims are not preempted by either the EESA or HAMP. Rather, Wells Fargo asserts for the first time on appeal that the Homeowners Loan Act preempts Wygod's claims. As stated before, there is no express preemption here. HAMP specifically requires banks to follow all state and local laws. There's no conflict preemption because, as we stated, Wygod qualified for the program. Providing modification agreements to qualified borrowers who comply with their requirements under their TPPs is entirely consistent with the program guidelines. Therefore, Wells Fargo is incorrect that it would be in breach of its SPA with the government by giving Wygod a modification. And finally, as this court explained in Ocwen, there is no field preemption under HOLA for state laws of general applicability. And it appears in their brief that Wells Fargo does not dispute that Wygod's breach of contract, express breach of contract claims, would not be preempted, nor would her fraud claims. Your Honors, I see that my white light is on. I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Go ahead, Ms. Witter. Thank you.
Very much.
Ms. Friedel?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Irene Friedel, and I'm representing Wells Fargo in this appeal. The District Court's January 25th decision should be affirmed in full, on precisely the grounds that the District Court relied upon. The case is about the integrity of the President's Home Affordable Modification Program. This is an attack on how the program operates. The case is also about a borrower, Ms. Wygod, who does not have a loan that she can afford. If that were so, if Ms. Wygod had been pre-qualified, Mr. Woodrow and I would not be standing here today. The fact is that the case relies on a false or implausible factual predicate that she was pre-qualified. She was not pre-qualified, and that is clear from the allegations in the complaint and from the trial period plan that is attached to the complaint. The trial period plan states that Ms. Wygod would submit documentation with her plan. She alleges that she did submit documentation with her plan. Wells Fargo could not have verified her eligibility based on that documentation before the start of the trial period plan. What Wells Fargo did and what the allegations of the complaint say are actually consistent with the supplemental directives under HAMP. Does Your Honor have a question?
I'm puzzled because I think this is the first time I'm hearing that theory, and it sounds like a pretty straightforward factual dispute that we could not resolve on a Rule 12b-6 motion.
Well, we have said in our briefs that, and the issue has come up, our briefs have said that she was not qualified, but it's neither here nor there because she does not have a private right of action under HAMP, and she is...
She alleges that she qualifies and that she was pre-verified. Are you asking us to disregard those allegations in this appeal?
That she alleges a number of things. She does allege that she was pre-qualified, and I'm saying that is a conclusory, implausible allegation, because she also says that with her trial period plan, she submitted documents. That is consistent with how the program ran for unverified trial period plans at the time. Documents were submitted by the borrower along with the trial period plan. The servicer would review the documents, as it did here, and determine during the trial period whether the borrower qualified for a permanent modification, and thereafter it would notify the borrower when the trial period plan had been completed. And that's exactly what happened here. We have Wells Fargo's letter to Ms. Weigott at the conclusion of the trial period plan stating that based on the financial documents she submitted, she did not qualify for a permanent modification. That is also consistent with how the program was rolled out by the president and by the Treasury. Borrowers were we were in a state of national crisis. Borrowers needed immediate payment relief. And Treasury said to these servicers in Wells Fargo, you need to get borrowers on trial period plans so they can get the benefit of immediate payment relief during the trial period.
Okay. Can you direct me to this argument in your brief that she was never pre-qualified?
I don't have my brief in front of me. It's on the table.
Please.
It is in our factual background section.
Because what you're describing now is a sort of Twombly and Iqbal argument that we should disregard the plaintiff's allegations. And that's a very different case from the one you've presented in your brief.
Well, I raise it. The real issue here is whether Ms. Weigott can bring contract claims and state law claims to enforce the trial period plan. So whether she is pre-qualified or not really is not an issue.
Okay, so we can proceed on the assumption that she was pre-qualified, as she has alleged, and the question then is whether the TPP is enforceable as a contract.
Even assuming she was pre-qualified, I believe our arguments are... The arguments are the same in that she does not have the right to bring state law contract claims to enforce the application of HAMP guidelines to her loan by Wells Fargo. That is supported by a number of cases. It is not an issue of preemption. It is clear that what the court looks at congressional intent to determine whether a private right of action or whether a borrower or a plaintiff can bring state law claims. In this case, there is no private right of action under the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. There is no right under HAMP separately for borrowers to dispute the application of the waterfall process to their loan. In this case, Mr. Woodrow just stated that he does dispute how the waterfall was applied to Ms. Weigott's loan. That's an issue. That's a right that he doesn't have, that his client doesn't have, to dispute directly through a private action how the waterfall was applied. And we know from what has happened around the country in these courts that we are going to have inconsistent adjudications. Right now, we know, we've done a sort of a survey of the case law, there are at least 50 cases where motions to dismiss have been filed and ruled on by courts in similar HAMP cases. In the majority of them, the motions to dismiss have been granted in full. In roughly 10% of them, motions to dismiss have been denied in full. And in about 34%, there have been motions to dismiss granted in full granted in part and denied in part. These are all, we have district courts in different parts of the country saying in some cases the trial period plan is an enforceable contract. In other cases, the courts are saying the trial period plan is not an enforceable contract. For example, Wells Fargo now has had 4 cases where motions to dismiss have been granted in full. In 2 cases, motions to dismiss have been denied. So if we're in Massachusetts, you're a Wells Fargo customer, you have a trial period plan that may be an enforceable contract. But if you're in Illinois, you don't. Or if you're a servicer in Illinois, for example, One West in the Fletcher case, One West borrowers may have an enforceable trial period plan. A Wells Fargo borrower in Illinois may not.
That's what we're here for.
But so we have the problem arising right before us of inconsistent adjudications.
So where's your congressional intent? Where do you get it?
There was no intent to provide a private right of action because there is no private right of action. And that indicates that Congress did not intend that borrowers would be pursuing these claims. The overall purpose of the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act was to stabilize the economy, and in there was an authorization to provide the Treasury with the authority to develop a program to modify loans for the purpose of avoiding loans that where foreclosure was avoidable.
Suppose we don't agree with you, and we believe that you can maintain certain state causes of action within the statutory scheme. What happens to this case then? What's the next step in this case procedurally?
Procedurally, we would go back to the district court, and we would begin to engage in discovery. It would be probably wide-ranging discovery because it's a putative class action, and then the parties may file motions for summary judgment. We might have a motion for class certification. We would certainly file a motion for summary judgment laying out the facts showing that Ms. Wygod did not qualify. She was reviewed. As I said, we wouldn't be standing here today if she was qualified. And she went through the escalation process at Wells Fargo. Borrowers do have remedies under the scheme. Mr. Woodrow said that these were hollow. But if you look at the public record, S Supplemental Directive 1015, which I managed to drop on the floor, now it's out of order, has a very extensive escalation process for borrowers. There's the process laid out in our brief through the Hope for Homeowners hotline, where borrowers can call, they get escalated. The Treasury Department has set up at least two different borrower response centers. One is called the HSC, HAMP Support Center.
What actual relief can these processes give?
So borrowers, they can escalate a complaint through a number of different ways, through either the MHA Help Center, the HAMP Support Center. They can call their Congress people, men and women. They've been doing that, elected officials. They can contact Wells Fargo's Office of the President, as Ms. Wygod did here. Escalated complaints come into the servicer, and then the servicer has to respond to the entities that sent the escalated case in. MHA Help, that's the Home Affordable Help Center set up by Freddie Mac and the Treasury, and the HAMP Support Center follow the escalated case and how it's resolved. And for cases that come through that escalation process, those entities have to sign off on the resolution of the escalated complaint. So the servicer has to respond and has to answer to those entities, and they have to concur with the ultimate resolution.
You say the servicer, you mean Wells Fargo?
Yes, sir, Wells Fargo is a servicer. So we have, through the Supplemental Directive 0901, there is an extensive reporting requirement.
Suppose, I'm not attributing this to your client as a reality, as a hypothetical, suppose Wells Fargo just stonewalls all the way up.
They get into trouble with the Treasury.
What kind of trouble do they get into?
Well, as we know, HAMP is as to non-GSE loans, like the Wygod loan, this is a voluntary program. And Wells Fargo and many other servicers that participate signed a servicer participation agreement with Treasury, and that is where all of the HAMP obligations flow from. What Treasury has done in some cases is withhold the incentive payments that are made to servicers. So the servicer is owed a number of thousands of dollars for loans that it's made. If it's not in compliance with requirements imposed by Treasury, the incentive payments don't get paid, and some servers have experienced that so far. Now, this is a delicate balance, and it's one of the reasons why I think private claims should not be pursued. This is a voluntary program. President Obama wanted this program to happen, wanted it to be effective, because we have so many borrowers in loans where they can avoid foreclosure if they meet the requirements of the program. And so we want to get those borrowers into modifications under HAMP, but not every borrower qualifies. The Treasury wants to have servicers participate, doesn't want them not to participate, so it's a carrot and a stick sort of enforcement policy that is being undergone. But all of these, the servicers are subject to extensive compliance audits. All of this information is transparent. It's posted on the website. The Treasury issues these very substantial program performance reports that actually specifically identify how servicers are doing under the program. Wells Fargo is listed here. Through this process, loan-level data is provided by the servicers to the Treasury as part of the audit, and Freddie Mac, or whoever's doing the audits, will review loan-level data, and they will require servicers to modify loans if they find an error, and that has been happening.
So, Ms. Friedel, If the President or Senator Durbin contact you about Ms. Weigo's claim,
yes,
what mandated response do you have?
Well, what Wells Fargo has to do, and this happens frequently, actually elected officials contact Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo escalates the complaint to the Office of the President and then goes through the loan to make sure that there's no error in the decision that was made. If there was an error, a modification will be provided to the borrower.
What mandates that response?
You know, if it's coming through an elected official, I don't know that Wells Fargo has any obligation to respond other than it's going to do that to stay in good relations with the Congress people.
So this is all a voluntary process with
if
the servicer?
If the escalation comes through the HAMP support centers, for example, if a borrower calls the Hope for Homeowners hotline and they get their case escalated to either the HAMP support center or the MHA center, then the servicer, Wells Fargo, has to answer to those agencies.
Has to? Is that in writing somewhere?
Yes, it's in Supplemental Directive 1015. And once a resolution is proposed by the servicer, the agency, the government, has to concur with the resolution. So it has to approve the resolution.
If they don't, what happens?
I can't answer that exactly. Either they say this has to be modified or there's going to be some sort of penalty.
I guess I'm having a little trouble. We have all of these nice voicemail trees that I'm sure you have to work through, and maybe you get past Wells Fargo, maybe you get to the Treasury, and so on. But I understand the plaintiff's claim to be a pretty straightforward breach of contract claim, in essence an option contract with some conditions subsequent. If I'm in compliance with this loan trial period and my representations in Section 1 continue to be true in all material respects, then the lender will provide me with a loan modification agreement, etc. Now, conditions, yes, but not subjective.
Well, the conditions.
I'm discretionary.
There is, a disagreement between, in this case, Wells Fargo and Ms. Weigott as to how those conditions are interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
The conditions must be read in Section 2G to include compliance with HAMP guidelines. There must be a condition that the servicer have verified the borrower for qualification for a permanent modification.
Okay.
And here there
those,
seems to
those
be a
aren't, you're not contending those are discretionary, are you?
No.
Okay. Now, I understand that there's a disagreement between you and the plaintiff about what the facts are here.
Or how to interpret the contract. I mean, here we have a contract. We would have a contract interpretation dispute.
And about what's the nub of that issue?
The nub is Ms. Weigott reads the contract to impose two material conditions. She makes her timely payments, and she submits documentation. When she does that, she gets the permanent modification. We say that you must include as one of the conditions, as laid out in Section 2G of the trial period plan, that the servicer have verified the borrower as eligible for a permanent modification based on the documents she provided.
Okay, and that's a pretty straightforward issue of contract law.
Right.
But your defense theories don't rely on that disagreement, as I understand them. You're saying there's simply nothing enforceable here at all.
Well, there is a few different issues. One is we don't think that TPP actually is a contract because it is part and parcel of the HAMP program. If it is a separate contract that can be viewed as a standalone contract under state law, as some judges have found it to be, then you can have interpretations and enforcement of the contract. They're at odds with the HAMP guidelines. You could have a judge say, and I think this has been happening, that the conditions are solely submission of payments and submission of documentation, and if the borrower does that, they get a permanent modification.
Oh, then maybe they're wrong.
Right.
Right?
Okay. Well, if they're wrong, then they're going to have servicers hypothetically required to modify loans that don't qualify under the program, and that's the hazard of having state courts involved or federal courts with state claims involved in this process. Those two, the trial period plan and the guidelines, have to be read together.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Friedel.
Yeah.
Rebuttal, Mr. Woodrow? Mr. Woodrow, did Ms. Weigott pre-qualify or not? Get pre-verified or not?
Yes, Your Honor. We absolutely allege that she was pre-qualified in paragraphs 34 through 36 of the amended complaint. Not only was she pre-qualified, Your Honor, she sent in her documents and her signed TPP agreement, and the bank sent back, as we allege at paragraph 35 and 36, its signed copy along with a letter congratulating her on entry into the program.
If she didn't get pre-verified, then we're all wasting a lot of time here, aren't we?
Correct, which is why our pleading was careful to state that she was indeed pre-qualified. Again, that's amended complaint 34 to 36. Your Honors, we agree with the defense that this case is very much about the integrity of the HAMP program. Borrowers have rights under their TPPs, and with respect to Supplemental Directive 15 that counsel has cited, 1015, it does state that if the Treasury does not sign off on the servicer's proposed resolution of the escalated complaint, that the complaint stays open. It doesn't state that the servicer can't then proceed to foreclose. It doesn't state that the Treasury has the authority to unilaterally reverse the servicer's decision. Rather, it simply states that the complaint will be left unresolved. And like I mentioned before, the MHAC committee that supposedly oversees this provides letters to borrowers that specifically states the MHAC does not commit to providing any response to the borrowers. Also, Wells Fargo provides no data or even a single example of where a borrower who was denied, who claimed that they were improperly denied, was able to escalate their complaint and receive any relief from the MHAC or any other agent of the Treasury. This is most likely because the EEESA specifically states that any relief, any remedies provided through the Treasury are not exclusive and do not prohibit relief to any other person. Your Honors, in the final analysis, Lori Weigod did everything asked of her under her TPP, obligating Wells Fargo to provide her a modification agreement for her signature. TPP agreements are enforceable under state law. They are called agreements. They contain classic if-then statements and even state that time is of the essence in all caps. There is no end-run doctrine, and there are no administrative remedies that provide borrowers with effective or mandatory relief. Wells Fargo waived its argument that claims are preempted, and even if that was not waived, the EESA and HAMP again specifically state that borrowers must follow, that servicers must follow state law. The initial judicial hostility has waned, Your Honors. Ms. Weigod respectfully asks that she get her day in court as opposed to calling her congressman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Woodrow. The case is taken under advisement. Our next case for the day is United States versus Reese, number 10-24.